Rich Lowry joins us on our podcast series. He is, of course, the well-known editor of National Review. He's all over the screen on conservative television and is also the token conservative, sometimes showing up on liberal television news. And he is the author of a very interesting new book titled Lincoln Unbound. Lincoln Unbound sounds a little bit like Prometheus Unbound.
Yeah, the book is about Lincoln as the foremost apostle of opportunity in American history, and I trace that through his own life, I trace it through his politics and his policy, and then draw some lessons for what we can learn from his example and his politics here in America today, where I think we're having a crisis of opportunity and a crisis of the American dream. But he was really, you know, he grew up in an extremely poor, isolated areas of Kentucky and Indiana before he eventually moved to Illinois. And part of the, you know, what defined him his entire life was his ability to rise out of those difficult and limited circumstances. So it's Lincoln Unbound, and eventually, thanks partly to his efforts, America Unbound.
You know, this way of constructing an image of Lincoln brings at least two people to mind, two observers. One is, of all people, Horatio Alger. In some ways, you're finding Lincoln an exemplary figure in a Horatio Alger story of self-improvement and of grasping at what is available and making the best of it. But what also comes to my mind is the caution given by Benedetto Croce, who was one of the great philosophers of history, almost in the pre-modern moment, who says, this is just one little epigram that is memorable. He says, all history is modern history, by which he means that as you retell history, as you shape the narrative, and certainly as you shape the historical biographical narrative, which is what you're doing here, you are in some sense seeing the past, and in this case, a very significant past person, seeing him through contemporary colored eyeglasses, so to speak, seeing him as relevant to the concerns of this time rather than his time. Does that apply as possibly a cautionary consideration?
Yeah, well, a couple things. One, Horatio Alger, you're absolutely right. Before there was a Horatio Alger writing books, there was an Abraham Lincoln as the quote-unquote self-made man, which was that phrase was supposedly used for the first time by one of Lincoln's great heroes, the senator and serial presidential candidate, the great Kentucky statesman Henry Clay. Turns out Clay didn't say it himself, but this was sort of the motto of Henry Clay-style Whigs, that you could America was a country where you could make your own way, and it required a free economy, but also a diverse and vibrant economy that just wasn't entirely agricultural, that was industrializing, that had markets that were knit together with roads and canals and railroads, and required people to improve themselves. So the key word for Lincoln's Whigs was improvement, internal improvements to build these methods of knitting together markets, and just as important, self-improvement. And of course, Lincoln, he exemplified that himself, and he wanted other people to live that way as well.
If you translate that into a kind of a directive, it sounds as if Lincoln is saying to himself all along two things: work as hard as hell and grab the moment.
Absolutely. And there are these wonderful letters he wrote to aspiring law students who wrote to him later in his career saying, you know, how do I become a lawyer? How do I study to become a lawyer? And to one of them, he just said, work, work, work. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to have a three-word motto for the Lincoln ethic, that's a pretty good one.
Rather reminds you of how do I get to Carnegie Hall? Practice, practice, practice.
Exactly. It's exactly the same sentiment. And there, on the flip side, these letters to the law students were quite encouraging. They're quite excoriating letters from Lincoln to his stepbrother. He had a very complicated relationship with his family because his father really exemplified a different way of life, which had its virtues, you know, which is subsistence farming, very simple way of life. You don't have to test or exert yourself too much. And Lincoln's relatives, sort of a number of them, stayed in that way of life, including his stepbrother, who was always short on money, short on cash, and he was constantly trying to borrow money from Lincoln. And you know, Lincoln would write letters back to him saying, "Look, you're not a bad guy. You're perfectly capable of taking care of yourself. But your problem with you is you're an idler, meaning you don't work, and especially you're not involved in the cash economy." And again, this undergirded the entire Lincoln vision, is how do we get this country, the markets in this country, knit together, and how do we have a cash economy where people just aren't growing their own potatoes for their own subsistence?
So do we find him much involved in these questions or preoccupied with them long before he gets to the presidency?
Yeah, no, this is his entire career is devoted basically to this theme. Now, the Civil War represents obviously a huge historic challenge, and it involves many, many dramatic events, and that's why people tend to focus on that. But I argue, unless you get to Lincoln prior to that point and understand what animated him prior to that point, you can't truly understand what his purpose was. And he had two broad kind of strategic goals. One was kind of to end the subsistence economy he grew up in, because he didn't think that was very suited for a society of opportunity where people of diverse talents and interests had a chance to make the most of themselves and to rise, and to also eventually defeat the slave South. Now, he never imagined he was going to have to do it in a war, but he opposed the slave South, one, because it was a hierarchical and aristocratic system, as he saw it, and two, obviously, it was based on fundamentally blighting the opportunity and denying opportunity to a whole class of people. And this gets to another just fundamental premise of Lincoln's worldview, is you work for your own bread. You earn your living through your own sweat and toil. And he comes back to that again and again. There's a line in Genesis that he quotes to that effect over and over again. And the slave South violated that premise because it was based on the theft of other people's labor.
If he had a family crest, which I guess he didn't, he might have had on it the Roman saying, carpe diem, seize the day, because it's clear that also, apart from dedication to hard work and to moving yourself forward, you need to know, and his view seems to have involved this, you need to spot your opportunities and grab at them and fully utilize them. What were some of his major grabs on into his future?
Well, there are a couple of things. One, as soon as he left home, and he wanted to leave home very early because his father was supporting a big family, didn't have a lot of resources, so he hired Abe, and he hated being called Abe, but he hired his son out to work for others, and then until Lincoln was age 21, his father could just take all the proceeds of his labor. And again, this gets to the premise we were just talking about. You should earn your own food and toil for your own money and resources. And Lincoln actually referred to himself, he said once, "I used to be a slave." So he took this very personally. As soon as he was age 21, he left. He was very attracted to the rivers, which were kind of the commercial thoroughfares of that time. They really opened up vistas to a whole different, wider world. He was attracted to merchants, the first guy in New Salem, Illinois, where he went and struck out and lived on his own, was a merchant who was a big believer in Lincoln's talents, but he kind of bumped around a lot. He was a surveyor. He was an assistant postmaster. He opened his own store that went out of business. None of this was extremely successful, but very notably, almost immediately, the first thing he did as a 23-year-old kid was run for office. Lost the first time, won the second time, went to the state house in Illinois, and almost immediately people realized just what a talented polemicist he was, what a talented writer and arguer he was, and he was around, you know, a whole kind of higher class of people, if you want to put it that way, than he was in the rest of his life, and it was being around those legislatures that gave him the idea of being a lawyer, and that's eventually how he rose to respectability, and he spent the rest of his life basically in the law, and seeking political office.
Does he in any significant way actually write economic theory or political philosophy in a way that represents what you take to be a parallel to our current conservative concern with the restoration of free enterprise and rewards for individual effort. Do we find in the corpus of his writing?
Yeah, he cared about economics very much. And this goes back, Milt, I didn't mean to dodge one of your you had a two-part question back a little while ago where you're asking about the danger of kind of reading the present back into past. And I don't want to distort Lincoln in that sense. He was a government activist. He supported the tariff. He supported funding for these big transportation projects, canals and railroads, and he supported kind of government and government-regulated banking. And so he was more activist than conservatives are today. I think you have to consider the context, which is very important. One, you know, the financial markets were extremely immature and limited at that time. So if you wanted to build a big railroad, it was going to be very hard to do it at all without some form of government support. And all these Lincoln policies, these three pillars of his economics, had to do with creating a country that was knit together better so markets could work. They had to do with creating a diverse and an industrializing economy, again, so we all didn't have to be farmers, which was sort of the Jeffersonian vision, where you'd actually have industry and diversification, and we wouldn't just be dependent on Britain for manufactured goods and just send them our raw, unprocessed products. So it was really a vision of a market, commercializing market economy and a cash economy.
It's interesting see him grabbing for opportunity by running for the state legislature and getting to Springfield in that role by the age of 23. That brings to mind another later American president, the only other one, I think, who vaults from the Illinois legislature to the presidency of the United States in just a few years. How do you compare the use of opportunity and the use and the reliance upon individual gumption and individual ambition as we look at these two Illinois-based presidents, Lincoln and I think you know who the second one is?
Yeah. Well, they're both very ambitious, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with ambition in America. I fault Barack Obama fundamentally distorting Abraham Lincoln, and he kind of reduces Abraham Lincoln down to his support for subsidies for railroads and canals, and then broadens out from that basically into the argument that Abraham Lincoln would have supported all the government we have today, which I argue would just be completely unimaginable to him. And a lot of the government that we have today really violates Lincoln's fundamental views. I just can't imagine Lincoln supporting taking money from some people and giving it to other able-bodied people. That is not how the world was supposed to work in Lincoln's point of view. So he had a much greater appreciation for property rights than any liberal or progressive did today. He literally worshipped the founders. He would recoil for the sort of contempt that we see from the left and from the media for those conservative Republicans who revere the founders today. You know, people look at Ted Cruz like he has an antenna on his head when he talks about the Constitution. Lincoln would not be able to understand that at all and would be there with Cruz and his worshipful attitude toward the founders. So I think Obama is distorting Lincoln, and I think it behooves us as conservatives to resist that and fight back against it.
That brings us inevitably to the present moment. And with no great subtlety, I've segued you from Lincoln to Barack Obama and the crisis of the moment, which is really just a reflection maybe of a long-running process in which we've seen some transformation of the very concepts of how you use the presidency and of where this country ought to be going. We're talking on June 4th, and this will be heard within a few days and will be available as a podcast on into the possibly infinite future. But still, positioned as we are right now in the middle of this present crisis involving not merely IRS supervision and freezing or chilling effects exerted upon conservative organizations, but more broadly, increasing use of governmental agencies to control political discourse and to inhibit political discourse from the opposition, if you view the current crisis in those terms, as I do and some of your colleagues do, surely. What then is your read of the real nature of the present situation and the dangers associated with it and possibly the promise associated with it if we can rectify?
Yeah, well, clearly, and the myth, I think, is being exploded day by day that this was just a rogue operation out of Cincinnati.
Yeah.
And, we're now getting indications that the employees in Cincinnati really resent this line of defense because they know it was coming from Washington and they wouldn't have been doing this if they hadn't been told. What remains to be seen is whether there's any connection between the IRS office in Washington and the White House. And if you eventually get that in some real way, it's going to be obviously extremely explosive. And I think there are two kind of deeper points, Milt, that I think you're getting at here. One is, when we talk about the First Amendment, it seems oftentimes journalists seem to believe it exists only for them. You know, if there's a subpoena of the AP, well, that's a horrible violation of the First Amendment in effect because it's chilling journalists' work. But then when it comes to anyone else who wants to get involved in politics or spend a lot of on politics, which should be allowed in a free country, well, then they don't have so much respect for the First Amendment. So I just think that this goes to just we should have as political activity in this country should be as unregulated as possible, because the more regulated it is, the more chance you have for shenanigans of this nature that we're seeing at the IRS. And the second point is even a deeper one, which is that the more government you have, the more control it's going to have, the more influence over people's lives it's going to have, and the more chance there is for distortions and bias of this nature.
There's a talismanic number hanging in the air before us, and it looms larger and larger. I think the number is 144 or 146, namely the number of visits that Shulman made to the White House during, I don't know whether it was during a 1 year or during his tenure running the IRS, but either way, it speaks volumes with regard to White House investment in and White House control of IRS policy. Yet that's denied at every hand by the government, by the White House itself.
I wouldn't get too hung up on that number just because two things. One, a lot of those visits were to Nancy DeParle, the health care czar, or whatever her title was. And two, cabinet officers' visits to the White House aren't logged in the same way, so we might be getting a slightly distorted picture with that number. But it is extremely notable that every single person involved in this controversy so far that we're aware of, all the indications are that they're a Democrat. You know, Shulman, although he was appointed by a Republican, gave $500 to the DNC. And his wife is extremely liberal and involved in a so-called liberal public interest group. And that's true of the spouses of all these people that are involved in this. So what we're supposed to believe, you listen to David Fluff and the others, is that all these liberal people just decided to apply the law differently to conservatives, and it had nothing to do with politics. And there are a number of rejoinders to that. My favorite is just, you know, Milt, if this had been happening to the progressive groups and progressive groups had been out there complaining about it and had Democratic lawmakers complaining about it and asking the IRS about it, the IRS would have fixed it. The White House would have picked up the phone, asked what the heck was going on at the IRS, and it would have been taken care of. It wasn't, because all these people are reflexively inclined to believe that there's something wrong with the Tea Party, there's something wrong with conservatives.
A deeply disturbing aspect of the present situation, and it's really a disturbing aspect of the 5 years so far of the Obama presidency, is that apart from people like you and some of your colleagues at the National Review and elsewhere in the limited range of conservative journalism, but in the main, American journalists and commentators and so on, are turn a blind eye virtually to scandals of this sort. And by now they have to address it somewhat, and a few are handling it by saying, well, let's get the Attorney General to resign. But there is a failure and a deep failing by the American journalistic community now with regard to any serious critical adversarial commentary about this administration and its works and ways. That was not the case even with prior Democratic administrations. I remember the hard time, I'm an old enough man to remember, though I was only a kid when it happened, the hard time they gave to Harry Truman, the press generally. And for that matter, even Bill Clinton got whacked around a good deal, certainly with regard to the individual and rather unbearable scandals that he brought upon us and brought upon the presidency, bringing some shame and dishonor. But this president and this administration generally seems to be, the cliche is that they are all, that it's a Teflon administration and they are all Teflon executives. It seems to me there's a good deal to that criticism, and one wonders why it's happening this way.
Well, they just fell in love with Barack Obama right from the beginning, really, as soon as he showed up in the Senate. And, you know, I'm not a fan of Hillary Clinton, but even I felt sorry for her during the Democratic nominating process in 08, because the coverage was so obviously tilted against her. And that wasn't an anti-Hillary thing so much as it was an expression of love for Barack Obama. And that's been the way it's worked for 5 years, basically. I do think we are in an interlude here where it's different. I think the media's interest in the Benghazi matter began to tick up at least a little bit with the Gregory Hicks whistleblower testimony. Then the IRS thing, you know, is so obviously indefensible. You had the even the press to some extent outraged by it. And then you had the AP thing, which just hits them where they live. And the James Rosen thing, which their credit, they've most reporters have been denouncing that.
So yeah, well, when it cuts really close to home,
they finally
get aroused, don't
they?
I think
we're in this period, Milt, where the press has become more hostile. And I just think it'll inevitably flip back. And especially if any of these scandals grow to the point where it really threatens the president in a fundamental way, then we'll see the press definitely flip. And that's what happened during the Monica scandal and the impeachment controversy with Bill Clinton. Yeah. Everyone was pretty excoriating because, I mean, no one could defend what had happened or what he had done. But then there was this famous Maureen Dowd column that you read the whole thing thinking that she was denouncing the sexual obsession of Bill Clinton. And at the end, it turns out what she was really saying was that Ken Starr was obsessed with sex.
I remember.
That was sort of a turning point with the press. And if these scandals were to grow or become even more serious and it were to threaten President Obama in a more fundamental way, I think you'd see the press turning again.
Then there's the special penchant that some sectors of the press have for singling out particular conservative public figures, whether as candidates or as legislators or what have you, and reviling them with condescending scorn and condescending amusement. The best case in point is the former governor of Alaska. It just becomes absolutely required, especially if you're a woman and on the left or of the progressive variety, to treat her with utter contempt.
Yes, and particularly if you're a woman, but she's since she's not so much center stage anymore, I think you see that sort of contempt, I would argue, now being directed towards Ted Cruz. I think
yes.
He's kind of the new hate figure. You know, people say he's like Joe McCarthy. People say they don't like the way he looks. And there always has to be some hate figure. And he's the newest candidate.
They need to have one just about every day, you're saying.
Yeah, there's always one. And, you know, what I love about Cruz is that he's so capable, and especially in these congressional hearings, where if you watch them, oftentimes it's just extremely frustrating, where no one, Republican or Democrat, is very good at following up a line of questions logically and getting, trapping witnesses or getting them to make admissions they don't want to make or stopping them from filibustering. And Cruz just has a wonderful prosecutorial style. And you can tell, you know, it drives his targets crazy. It drives Democrats crazy. But God bless him. He just has a natural talent in that way as a pretty exceptional lawyer. And he's making the most of it. And he has sort of consciously, I think, decided going to the Senate, look, I'm not going to wait 1 year, 2 year, three years to begin to try to make the maximum impact. I'm going to do it immediately. And that's also ruffled some feathers.
What is the strategy of a significant conservative journal like yours with regard to evaluating and judging contemporary issues in our political life and in our economic life as touched by political achievement and political manipulation? And one wonders, there are other rather respectable journals of a different order. Your obvious competition or your obvious opposite number, but not fully opposite, would be the New Republic. What philosophy guides National Review? What sort of, and what view of the American future? And what philosophy and what sort of view of the American future guides, would you guess, the New Republic?
Well, the New Republic, you know, was there at the invention of progressivism, and which believes in kind of rule by experts and technocrats, and the believes in the capability of government. And we tend to believe the opposite. You know, we believe in life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. We believe the Constitution set up the best mechanism to protect that ultimate purpose of American life. And there are certain sort of key functions of government that we would always want it to provide: national defense, law enforcement, the basic rules of a capitalist society, some very basic public goods like infrastructure. But besides that, we think, you know, individuals are the best judges of their way in this world, and so our default is always to liberty.
And you find that Lincoln took essentially the same view.
I do, yeah. And again, I mean, there are certain public goods that he thought were very important, but besides that, he was a believer in individual achievement. And he never would have, this when we're talking about Obama and Lincoln, this is another point I meant to make but didn't get to. He hated class warfare, just hated it. And the whole rhetoric of the president throughout his presidency, especially during the 2012 presidential campaign, would have repelled him. You know, Lincoln said to a delegation of working men who came to the White House during the war, if you are houseless, don't tear down the house of another.
Yes.
Build your own. And he said, I believe, in another context, that he wouldn't support any law to prevent anyone from getting rich, because getting rich is a good thing, one. And two, it provides an incentive for people who aren't rich yet to get rich themselves. You know, and that's a very kind of Jack Kempian sentiment. And
yeah, one recognizes it as something like that. Let me, as a final matter, let me go back to your book and note that the subtitle for Lincoln Unbound is How an Ambitious Young Rail Splitter Saved the American Dream and How We Can Do It Again. So the last essential question is, how can we do it again?
Well, we have some challenges. You know, you mentioned Horatio Alger earlier, and that's the kind of society we envision ourselves as. It's not as true as we would like it to be. There are a number of countries around the world that are more mobile than the United States, and I think that's the key thing to focus on. It's not so-called inequality. It's mobility. You know, are people who start out in the bottom, are they able to make more of themselves and rise? And you have other English-speaking countries that are better at that, Western European and Scandinavian countries that are better than that, better than we are at that. You also have it's real struggles among the working class, where you have lagging wages for all sorts of reasons. And you also have, and I think this is a crucial thing to focus on, a breakdown in culture and social order and the family. And the the traditional two-parent family is becoming increasingly the preserve of college-educated people. You know, in terms of education, the top educated 30% of the country or so. And I think that's just a disaster. So I think what we need is kind of a Lincolnian program, which in broad brush is a economic dynamism, and we need new structures. So much of what we have is inherited from the mid-20th century. We need to be willing to modernize and move away from things that don't work anymore the way Lincoln was. Two, we need education. We need a better education system. It almost all starts there. And three, we just need more of an ethic of discipline, or as I call them, kind of the bourgeois virtues. You know, these aren't Bible thumping the virtues. They're very basic. Work, showing up for work on time, self-discipline, family, and marriage. And these are the kind of basics that make it possible for people in this country to make the most of themselves. And if you don't have them, you know, some people can make it anyway, but it's much harder, and a lot of people just end up running in quicksand.
And how will all of that be facilitated by Obamacare?
Oh, it won't at all. And that's the key thing. You know, it's going to – part of my advice to Republicans is we focus so overwhelmingly on income taxes, and, you know, they're important. They especially were much more important, you know, in the Reagan years when, you know, the top rate was 70% or so. We've won a lot of victories on income taxes, so they're not quite as important. Other things matter more to middle-class families, or as much, at least, price of health care, you know, the ability to get health insurance in the first place, and the cost of college. And I think a conservative program that connects with the discontents of today has to address those bread-and-butter matters. And if Republicans were better at addressing them, I believe, it would help us with everyone, including young people, including Latinos.
Well, I am not at all surprised that you've handled all of these questions with lucidity and with absolute clarity. And I do thank you very much for joining us today. Rich Lowry has been our guest. He's well known to many of our listeners and to many viewers, as, of course, a frequent conservative commentator on the various news programs. And he is the editor of the National Review and the author now of the book to which we've adverted some, but we've hardly done it full justice, namely Lincoln Unbound. And with that, again, Rich, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Mel. I mean, I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Summer birds against a Swedish sky. The same.